Welcome to Salvation by Grace, a broadcast ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. For more information, we invite you to visit our website at www.salvationbygrace.org. Now let's join our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are starting this morning in John 16. Before we get started, I hold in my hand Lessons from Luke, Disc 5, the MP3 disc of Lessons from Luke, and it says right here in red letters, plus a bonus message. I couldn't help it. That's just my humor. I had to write that on the disc. The message from up in Lexington is on there as well. We're up to 5 discs, averaging 20 to 25 messages per disc. So we're well over 100, 110 messages just trying to get through the book of Luke. But like this morning, we're in John, which is part of Luke somehow. That is now available. That'll be in the front office for anybody who wants to copy it. Anybody on the internet who wants a copy of it, you know what you do. You send me an email, you say, send me a copy of it. We charge, what do we charge? We charge $5 for a disc. We charge $10 for 3. I don't think anybody hardly ever pays for them, and we send out lots of them. Because all you really have to do is ask, and we'll send it to you. But if you have the wherewithal to help us, send us a couple of bucks to defray the cost. In any case, that's available now, and Jeff, I will send you a blurb to put on the website on the disc page to say that that's now available. And very soon, we will have disc 2 of the Wednesday night series, because we've got 19 messages now, more since the first disc, so we're just continuing to crank out lots and lots and lots of teaching. Actually, it seems to me that we're not in John 16, it seems to me we're in John 15. Yes, that's where we left off. Last week, we left off at John 15, 17. That's how far we got. Now, 2 comments. As we wrapped up last week, I said, I'm not actually finished. I'm just taking a break for a week. There were 2 things that I wanted to go back and catch. One was a comment that Jeff made after the tape was off, and he brought up a very good point that needs to be expounded on this morning. And so we're going to do that for a moment. The second thing was, last week I was talking about unconditional love in relationships, in human relationships. And I made the point that most human relationships are based on take. And most human relationships are judged on how much that relationship is fulfilling you. So that we individually, in relationships with other people, judge the quality of the relationship on the basis of how much can I take from this relationship, how much does it satisfy me, how much does it make me feel better. And then I compared that to unconditional love, which does for the one who is being loved what is in the best interest of the one being loved, whether or not the one doing the loving is getting back what they want or not. Jesus was the perfect exemplification of that when he said, no greater love has any man than this, that he would lay down his life for his friends. And the people he was talking about doing that for are going to flee, scatter, deny him, swear, run away. He's getting no benefit from the love relationship. But he is sacrificially doing for the one he loves exactly what the one he loves needs done, despite the fact that Jesus is getting nothing directly out of the relationship in any kind of equality kind of way. That is what sacrificial love is. And that's why, as I pointed out last week, that is why Paul would then use that exact language to say, husbands, love your wives, and give yourselves for them as Christ gave himself for the church. That is the perfect application of sacrificial love, the way Christ sacrificially loved. Paul then picks it up and moves it into the marriage relationship and says, now, husbands, love your wives that way, sacrificially, the way Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. And so I was really emphasizing last week that if you sacrificially love other people, whether that's a mate, whether that's your child, whether that's a friend, if you sacrificially love them, then you don't go around keeping score, keeping track, seeing how hurt you were, whether they lived up, whether you got back what you wanted. You love them for the sake of the person you're loving. And then I said, and I guarantee you, if you do that strong enough, long enough, committedly enough, you will eventually get back the very thing it is that you want. You will get that love in return. You will get that satisfaction, that sense of security in return. I said all that last week. Remember that? Okay, I bring that up because as I was saying it, and I'm not going to name names or point at anybody, but pretty much every couple in the room at some point pointed at each other, poked each other, or elbowed each other in the hope that their mate was hearing me. And if what you got from what I was saying was, boy, you need to hear this, you've missed my whole point. If you think that the reason I was saying that was so that you could say, if you would just do that, if you'd be like, you hear what he's saying? If you'd be like that, then I'd give you more of what it is you want, and you'd be happier if you would just start acting like, that's 180 degrees opposite of what I'm saying. I'm saying, right, that person isn't living up. Yeah, right, you're not getting what you want from that person. Exactly. Yes, they are failing whatever standard you have for them in the relationship. Right. That's why it's called sacrificial love. I wasn't saying it so that you could go, oh man, I know somebody who really needs to hear this. I was talking to you. I was talking to every one of us individually, because there's not a one of us who has yet risen to the point of sacrificial love, genuine sacrificial love. Genuine, I will do for the one I love what is necessary for the one that's being loved, even if I get nothing back out of it. Even if I never get anything back out of it. We are so fleshly, so sinful, so human, that we'll do the sacrificial love thing, but we put a limit on it. I'm going to do this for about 3 weeks. And if I don't see some changes, then I'm not going to do it anymore. Or you'll keep score. You know, I have been doing that whole sacrificial love thing Jim talked about now for about a month. And I haven't seen anything out of you, okay? Right? I mean, that's human relationships. That's not sacrificial love. That is not agape love. It is not what Jesus was saying. What did he get from these people that he died for? Nothing. Yeah. And what did he do for them? The sacrifice that he endured for them was a horrible sacrifice. The wrath of God that they deserved, he took on their behalf so that they will be someday in heaven. He's going to say it in his high priestly prayer soon, so that they can see his glory. He did all of this for them. But he also says, now, Father, return me to the glory that I had before the worlds were. He's going back to his glory anyway. He's going to get back everything anyway. All he's doing is giving sacrificially to his people something they couldn't otherwise have ever attained on their own, but it doesn't change him. He was God to start with. He continues to be God. He's in his glory. He's still going to have the angels around him. He continues to sit at the right hand of the Father. The only thing that changed as a result of his sacrificial love wasn't that those people got better or loved him more and gave him more. What happened was he did for them sacrificially what they couldn't do for themselves, and they gained all the benefit. That's exactly how Paul said human relationships ought to work, that we love sacrificially. Now, let me be cautious here. That does not mean that if you're married to somebody who beats you, that you're supposed to just lay down and take it. That's not what I'm saying. Just so nobody says, yeah, Jeff went, that's good. Huh?
I got an out now.
You got an out now? Good, good. I am not saying that you need to lay down and be abused. That's a whole other subject. What I'm talking about is your relationship to the brethren, which is exactly the way that Jesus framed it. Jesus framed it as the relationship between the brethren, the way that God loved Christ. Christ loved his own, therefore his own should love each other. He even says it, the way that I have loved you. And then he exemplifies it in saying, and no greater love has any man than this, than that he would lay down his life for his friends. So then we as brethren, as Christian brethren, the standard is Christ's love. That's the kind of love we should have for each other. A sacrificial love that is willing to lay down your life for each other. And that is the polar opposite of a relationship that says, I'm in this for me. What do I get out of it? What can I do? I'm not satisfied. I'm not happy. I'm not getting everything out of it. Therefore, I'm going to bail out of this relationship. You understand that? So I just wanted to point out, the whole poking each other thing, if you did that, you missed the point. I wasn't talking to your mate. I was talking to you. Okay? Secondly, look at John 15, 16, where Jesus said, and I continue to point out, that he's speaking specifically here to the 11 apostles at this point. Judas is out doing the betrayal thing at this moment, and he is speaking to them very specifically, which is obvious from verse 26 or verse 27 when he says, you'll bear witness of me because you've been with me from the beginning. It's very clear that he's talking specifically to his apostles. And here's what he says to them. You have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and have ordained you. So far, who did all the stuff? He did. Did he say anywhere in here anything about free will? Did he say anything about you stood back and assessed for a while and determined that it would give you a healthier, better, more profitable life if you would just choose me? There's none of that. He said, you did not choose me. I chose you and I ordained you that you should go and bring forth fruit. Now, what do you suppose that phrase bring forth fruit means? In practical terms, what does it mean when Jesus is talking about fruit and bearing fruit, bringing forth fruit? What does that mean?
That you're in the vine.
Yeah, in this case, that you're in the vine, that you, but even that, you're using, again, allegorical language. What is a practical demonstration of fruit?
Fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness.
That's the fruit of the Spirit, love, patience, kindness, but how would that manifest itself? Good works, right? Isn't that essentially what we're talking about? Even if you're talking about patience and kindness and love and sacrifice, all it's just good works. Because one of the things that we are so often accused of is that, you know, well, Jim, if we believe the way you teach, then you don't have to do anything to be a Christian. And I say, right, you don't have to do anything to be a Christian, but if you are a Christian, you will do things. And he's made it clear here that they will bear fruit. So within that fruit language, I'm the vine, you're the branches. As long as you abide in the vine, then you'll bear fruit. Without me, you can do nothing. All of that is that symbolic language of the relationship between he and them. But look at what he says. I have ordained you that you will go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit, your good works, your righteous works, should remain, that whatsoever you shall ask of my Father in my name, he may give it to you. So last week, Jeff pointed out, after the tape was off, that in that verse, it's very clear that, number one, even our good works, he gets credit for. We don't do the good works. He does them through us by the power of the Spirit in us, doing those good works. Same language that Paul uses, that the Spirit that was in us ordained us to walk in these good works. But secondly, it says your fruit will remain, which is really interesting language if you believe in the five tulip points. If you believe in the P point, which is perseverance, that we will continue in the Christian faith, continue in the Christian walk right up until the time of our ultimate redemption, here Jesus even takes credit for that. He says that your fruit will not only be born because I ordained it, but your fruit, your righteousness, will remain on the basis of the fact that it's Christ that's continuing it.
Paul says the same thing, that he who began a good work in you, Jesus did it,
right,
will be faithful to complete it.
He that began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it. Yep, absolutely. So that's a very consistent theology. That one more time, this is not just Pauline thinking. Jesus here very clearly is making sure that he takes credit for anything that's good about us. If we're loving, it's because the Spirit of God was in us. If we bear fruit, it's because the Spirit of God was within us. If our fruit remains, some form of righteousness that remains, that God actually counts as righteousness because the Spirit of God was in us. There's just nothing positive, good, Christian that we get to take credit for. Again, it's all Christocentric and it's all quite monergistic. So these things I command you, verse 17, that you love one another. So there's that command again. This is what Christ commanded. His last commandment before being killed, before essentially leaving the planet, when he came back, he didn't change any rules. The last big rule that he keeps emphasizing is love one another. And it's agape, agapao is the verb. It's that you will sacrificially love one another. So can you say that you have any excuse for not sacrificially loving other saints, other Christians? No, it's a command. It's a direct command from your Lord. People will say Lord to him. People will say he is my Lord, my King. He is the Savior on his throne. And then you say, okay, then do you do what he says? He said sacrificially love people. Do you do it? No, but it's okay. He understands. That's fine. No, it's a command from your Lord. If you're going to use the word Lord, which means he is the overseer and captain of our salvation, there's one place where he's even called the despot, the king over his church. He's in absolute control, and the only command he gives you, and he gives it to you consistently and repeatedly, is love one another sacrificially. As God loved Christ, as Christ loved his people, so we should love one another. If, look at verse 18, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love his own. But because you were not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Does that sound like the health, wealth, prosperity message? Come to Christ and it's all going to go good. Come to Christ, have a great time. Let me show you the mail I got just this week. I brought some with me. Because we used to meet at my house, and because the business office in many ways for the church is out of my house, a lot of this stuff comes straight to my house. Northside Baptist Church, Murfreesboro, sends a letter to Grace Christian Assembly. Dear youth workers and church staff members, this is our last reminder that you need to make your reservation for this year's Judgment House. They used to call it Hell House, right? Man, I guess somebody complained, now it's Judgment House. This year, their theme is In the Twinkling of an Eye. Like room one will be revival, room two, bedroom, da 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 da. Room three will be the party, room four, the car accident. Yeah, you knew that was coming, right? Yeah, okay. Room 5, TV station studio, don't know what that's about. Room 6, heaven. Room 7, bedroom, scene 2. And then apparently after walking through this and dramatizing the rapture, then in, you know, the last room, they have an opportunity for the kids to make a profession, give their life to Christ, not based on anything they read in the Bible, not based on any theology or doctrine, based on the little play they're going to see as they go from room to room. But they're very excited because they said, despite the difficulty in dramatizing the rapture, I feel very confident that it will be the best one we have ever done over the last 3 years. In fact, to make it realistic, I have David Allen, a Christian illusionist from Georgia. And the funny part about that sentence is that the word Christian is both bold and italicized. So it's not just a magician from Georgia, it's a Christian magician from Georgia who's going to apparently make some people disappear so it looks like the rapture. And because of the illusions, I expect this to be one of our most attended judgment houses yet. You know what? First off, as far as I'm concerned, my daughter, young person, target audience for this, will not be going. Why? Because she never has to go to judgment, nor judgment house, nor anything with the word judgment in it, nor hell house, nor anything with the word hell in it, because it turns out that Christ paid for her sins, raised for her justification, and she never has to worry about judgment. So do I really need to try to scare her into making a profession by watching magic tricks of kids disappearing after they've been to the bedroom and then immediately there was a car wreck so they didn't have a chance to repent and choose Jesus so they went to hell? Oh no, da 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 da, make your profession now. Do it because it's Halloween. And so... now, here's another thing I got just this week. Two church-wide spiritual growth campaigns created by Rick Warren. Imagine what would happen if every member of your church discovered God's purpose for their lives in 40 days. It's 40 days of purpose. You know what I think? I think we're such a smart church. I think we can knock this out in 30. We don't need to go 40 days. 25 good solid days of purpose. I think we've got it. More than 25,000 churches have helped millions of people understand and live out God's purpose through 40 days of purpose and 40 days of community. Do you understand what that claim says? 25,000 churches have helped millions of people to understand and live out God's purpose for their life through 40 days of purpose and 40 days of community. Hang on, let me check something. If the world hate you, you'll know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Okay, just checking. They will learn how to have, through these intensive church-wide spiritual growth campaigns, where you get a free video and resource samples available for download and 40-day stories of renewal and growth from churches of every imaginable size, denomination, and personality, you want to register today to discover the power of a church connected in a small group community. It's the 2006 winter campaign, 40 Days of Purpose.
Hey, interesting that it's interdenominational, i.e. no doctrine.
No doctrine.
Any offensive doctrine.
No theology.
To the point where that, right. That one I sent out where he's now being elicited from the Jewish rabbis on, well, you did so well, right. These megachurches, teach us how to do
right.
That. He's helping.
40 days for Jewish purpose.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you can't possibly sell that many books and that many videos and that much stuff over 25,000 churches if you're doing doctrine. You can't divide. You can't say I stand for anything in order to hit that kind of mass market. You have to say, we don't really believe in anything except up with people. Everything be good. Everything's great. Discover your purpose. Be happy. Do good. Then I got the Christian booksellers. Christian book distributors got their newest catalog right there on the front cover. Joel Osteen's Your Best Life Now. Now. This is the kind of stuff that will let you, you know, preach in an $80 million edifice. What you believe about yourself today can determine who you will become tomorrow. Let's talk about what you need to believe about yourself today. Okay, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his master. If they've persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they had kept my sayings, they will keep your sayings also. But all these things will they do unto you for my name's sake, because they don't know him that sent me. If I had not come and spoken unto them, they would not have had sin. But now they have no cloak for their sin. He that hates me hates my Father, and they're going to hate you. But don't worry about any of that. No, here's what Joel wants you to know. What you believe about yourself today can determine who you will become tomorrow, for good or for ill. So don't believe that people hate you.
Or that you're totally depraved.
Or that you're totally depraved. You don't want to believe that kind of stuff. You want to believe good about yourself, because that's when good things will happen for you. Beginning with this premise, Pastor Osteen challenges Christians to trade their worldly insecurities for a God-informed self-image. Discover your innate strengths and abilities, and then advance down the road toward health, abundance, significance, and success. Now, let me ask you a question. Can you plug those words into John 15 and make it make sense? Can you? Because if you can't, then Joel's wrong. But this book is selling millions of copies, because it's telling you that if you're a Christian, you're going to figure out what your strengths are, and then you're going to become significant. That word significant just absolutely boggles me. You're going to become significant. Significant to who and in what frame? Significant in the world? Well, if you were of the world would love its own. In other words, it seems to me that if you're becoming significant on a worldly level, then you are trying to satisfy the very world that Jesus said hates him. And if you can be successful in the world, and the world does love you, then you're clearly not his own. The two are antithetical. Jesus never preached a message that said, come to me and you're going to be successful and you're going to be significant and you're going to have your better life now. Here's Jesus' version of what the apostles' better life now looked like. The servant is not greater than his Lord. If they persecute me, they will also persecute you. That's his vision of what their life now was because they had come to Christ. Because he had chosen them, they now were going to be persecuted by the world, and it didn't matter that they wanted a, quote, better life now. Christianity has never been about the better life now. It has always said, we are strangers and pilgrims in this world. We're just passing through this world. This world is not our home. This world is temporary. There's nobody in this room who isn't getting older and sicker and gonna die. So if you invest all your time and effort in making a better life now, you stand a very good chance of missing out on the better life in the future. But the Bible continually, constantly, repeatedly says that sacrificing in this life will, to use Paul's language, result in a better resurrection. And since the resurrection is the doorway into forever, and since this life you get your maybe 70 to mess it up good down here, and then you're cast out into eternity, I'm perfectly willing to forego the better life now for the better resurrection then. I stand in complete opposition to the whole Osteen purpose-driven theology. It has no place in biblical thinking. But if you don't teach the Bible, which Joel Osteen doesn't, and which purpose-driven doesn't, then you can get away with telling people that what Christ wants for you is a better life now. But you don't find the apostles getting it, and as I've said too many times, if it's true that health, wealth, and prosperity is what the Bible actually teaches, then it seems like at least one of the people who wrote the Bible would have actually done that. Right? At least one writer of the Bible would have achieved health, wealth, and prosperity if the message of the Bible is health, wealth, and prosperity. But every one of the people who wrote the Bible died terrible deaths at the hand of the world that hated them. So I'm sorry, the Christian outlook is, if you're friends of the world, you're not a Christian. But if you are a Christian, the world hates Christ and they're quite likely to hate you. That's not going to sell books, though. Your best life now is always going to run off the shelves much quicker than sacrificial love and death and pain in this life by Jim McLarty. That's just not going to fly. You know? What were you going to say?
Nothing. Just Paul summing that up. In Romans 8, he said the Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs of Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us.
Two things are being said there, right? One is, we're going to suffer with him. We're heirs with Christ if we suffer with Christ. And the second was that the suffering of this life isn't to be compared with the glory of the heavenly life. And both of those are important factors. And where does it say it is given to us not only to believe, but to suffer? That's part of the package.
And what we read this morning in Romans 5 about tribulations in this life. And he said, we exult in our tribulations knowing that tribulation brings perseverance.
Yes.
And perseverance, character, and proven character, hope.
Yeah. We glory in our tribulations. The book of James starts out that it's no surprise that we should suffer in this life. I mean, that's a consistent theme because Christianity was always about suffering in this life. For unto you, this is Philippians 1:29. For unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ not only to believe on him. There's a very important phrase right there. That it was given to you to believe on Christ. The only reason you believe on Christ is that it was given. And we would love it if Paul had just truncated the sentence right there. Put a period right there. It's given to us to believe on Christ, period. There, we're elect, we like it. Except the second half of the sentence says, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake. That's part of it. There's nothing in there about your better life now. No, back to John, back to truth instead of the debris that comes in my mail all the time. Verse 19 of John 15, if you were of the world would love his own. Did Jesus there one more time make a distinction between the world and those that were his?
Yes.
Huge distinction. And he said, you either belong to him or you belong to the world. There's no gray area. You're one or the other. You're either in the world or you're in him. And if you are in him, then you're not in the world, and therefore the world will hate you. Why? He said the reason was because I have chosen you out of the world. You're no longer part of the world. You are now part of Christ's elect because he chose you out of the world. And because he chose you out of the world, therefore the world will hate you. But then just to make the distinction between the world and his own even more dramatic, turn over to chapter 17 for a moment. Starting at like verse 5, this is Jesus' high priestly prayer. We'll get to it in a week or two anyway, but I want to make this connection. Chapter 17, verse 5, and now, O Father, glorify me with your own self, with the glory which I had with you before the world was. I have manifested your name unto the men which you gave me out of the world. Do you see that? So now it's not just Christ chose them out of the world. These are the people that God gave Christ out of the world. So these are the people who God chose, who then Christ came to, and then who did Christ manifest God to? Those God gave him. I can't help it. That is awfully election-based language. He just said to them, you didn't choose me, I chose you. Now he's praying to the Father and saying, I manifested your name to those people you gave me and nobody else. Now, did he also try to manifest God's name to the rest of the world, but the rest of the world just rejected it of their own free will? No. Listen to what he says about them. I've manifested your name unto the men that you have given me out of the world. Thine they were, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. Now, they have known that all things whatsoever you have given me are of you, for I have given unto them the words which you gave me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I came out from you, and they have believed that you did send me. I pray for them. I do not pray for the world, but I pray for them that you have given me, for they are yours. Can't help it. That's what Jesus said. He said, in praying to God, I've manifested your name to these people and not to the world. And by the way, I pray for them and not for the world. Now, that's a huge distinction between the elect and the non-elect. And as a result of Christ choosing particular people, the unchosen world hates the people who were chosen. So, as it was then in his day, I don't think any of that paradigm has changed. Have you ever been hated without a cause in your life? Has there ever been anybody that's just hated you and you said, you know, I've done my best with you. I've been nice to you. I've done my... Jesus said they hated me without a cause, so they'll hate you without a cause. Sometimes it's mind-boggling to me. Sometimes I get email from people who just hate me, just vicious, just angry at me, that I would be out there on the internet saying the things I say. I'm becoming more and more convinced that there are some people listening to me who just listen out of spite. They just want to see what thing I'll say this week. You know, how far will this guy go? And they'll hear me read that verse, and they'll be able to open their Bible themselves and look at it and read it themselves, and they will still insist that it doesn't mean that, and that somehow that's my interpretation of it or something. It's the way I read it. But I can't help the fact that Jesus said, you're not of the world because I've chosen you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. And then prayed to his Father and said, I pray for those you gave me, and I don't pray for the world. Now, are we supposed to believe that right after he got done with this prayer, He was then dragged off before Pilate in front of Herod, and he went in front of Caiaphas and put up in front of the group, and then they all said, kill him. Are we really supposed to believe then that he went to the cross after all that and died for the sins of the very people he wouldn't even pray for? For the very people that he said will hate the ones he chose? And yet we're supposed to believe that he went to the cross and died for them? I find that incredibly difficult to believe. So back to 15. We'll go through all of Jesus' prayer bit by bit in a week or two. Let me tie two more pieces together here. You can see now the contrast between the way Christian brethren, driven by the same Spirit, in unity with Christ, the same way that Christ said that he and the Father are one, and then he said that we are all to be one in that same way, and then he said that we are one with Christ, he's in us, we're in him, he's our substitute, all of that unity language that I've made a lot of in the last few weeks. You can see that in all that unity of the body, and in the sacrificial love that we within the body are supposed to demonstrate to each other, you can see how it is the polar opposite then of the hatred that we'll get from the world. And you can see why it would be necessary that we within the body love each other sacrificially, because that's the only place we're going to find any love. Because the world is not going to be loving us, not going to be kind to us, and is going to hate us. You know, Jesus actually at one point said, woe to you when all men speak well of you. Isn't that a strange thing for him to say? Woe to you when all men speak well of you. Why would he say that? He could say that because he knew that if all men speak well of you, you're a man pleaser. You're out there trying to please the world. You're out there trying to sell a whole lot of books or selling a purpose-driven program. And you're out there saying, I don't care about doctrine or theology. I don't want to make any distinctions. I just want everybody to get together and, well, get together and buy my product is essentially what they want everybody to get together under. They don't really want them to get under Christ or under proper doctrine or under the Bible, but just kind of get together as a group and then buy some stuff from me. Christ said, if you are genuinely his, you're going to endure hatred in this world. And I guarantee you, the more Christian you become, biblically Christian you become, if you can be a Christian and you've never encountered any kind of difficulty from people, if you've never encountered any kind of resistance in your Christian walk, you ain't much of a Christian. Or you're one of those Christians that's so man-pleasing in your Christianity that you don't offend anybody. Everybody goes, oh, well, that's good. He's a Christian, whatever. But become a real Christian, a biblical Christian, a committed Christian to the doctrine that the Bible actually teaches, people will not like you more, they'll like you less, and most of the resistance that you will get will come from within the religious world.
It's a lurking lot. Anytime they have MacArthur and the whole religious panel up there, it's always some Catholic guys, some liberal guys, Deepak Chopra, and John MacArthur, and he's always the bad guy.
Right.
Everybody is Jeff MacArthur.
Right.
And they're all representing some type of religion.
Exactly. And they're all representing some kind of religion that has their arms out and embraces everybody and loves everybody and won't ever say that anybody ever goes to hell or that sin's a problem. And then, yeah, poor MacArthur or somebody like that will step up and say, no, well, it says right this here in the Bible. Yeah, you're always the bad guy. Of course you're the bad guy. But that'll be that in our lives. I mean, we're going to run into that in our lives if you're truly, genuinely Christian. There are going to be people who just simply hate you. Now, did Jesus also give us a response to that? Yeah. He did not say that it was necessary for you to just stand there and take the beating. He said, don't cast your pearls before swine. That's also part of that balance that the Bible gives us. He said, if you cast your pearls before swine, they'll do two things. First, they'll trample your pearls, which if the pearls is the word of God, then what an insult to God that these people continue to trample his word. And he said, and then they will turn and rip you apart. And Jesus, knowing that that's going to happen, said, you don't have to put yourself through that. If you start talking to somebody about God and Christ and you're putting the Bible in front of them and it's clear that they just hate you, the Bible does not necessitate that you stand there and take the beating. They are, after all, in God's hands. He's going to have to work on their heart. He's going to have to change their heart, or they're never going to understand it, and you are not required to stand there and get ripped.
I think Paul is shaking the dust off of sinlessness.
Yeah, Jesus said to the 12 when he sent them out, he said, if they won't hear you, you go to the gate of the city, you shake the dust off your feet, and you pronounce a curse against that city, and you leave. And then he said, and it'll be easier for Sodom and Gomorrah in the judgment than it'll be for that city. So they're God's problem. Somebody hates you, can't hear it, doesn't want to hear it. You are not required to beat them over the head with your Bible until they hear you. And I like that the Bible gives us that balance. And by the way, so far, this is all Jesus teaching. This is that meek and mild, gentle, loving Jesus who wants everybody to come to him, who supposedly died for everybody's sins with his arms wide open because he loves you this much. I mean, all of that kind of thinking that wants to make Jesus into sort of a milquetoast who's waiting around hoping that somebody will come accept him. What's the Methodist church up the street? What's their sign say right now?
Jesus refuses no one.
But here, he wouldn't even pray for the world. But he refuses no one. Do you see how opposite that thinking is from biblical theology? Jesus is fine. Get this through your head. What did the sign say, Megan? If you ever feel neglected.
Yeah, do you feel neglected?
Do you feel neglected? Think how Jesus feels. Yeah. Do you feel neglected? Imagine how Jesus feels. Think about that for a moment. Think about people who could imagine Jesus sitting on his throne in glory with the angels around his head, feeling bad, feeling lousy because he feels neglected. And I said to Megan, look, Jesus does not feel neglected. Jesus does not feel let down because everyone whom the Father gives him will come to him. There's no neglect. And the people who don't come to him are the world he didn't pray for to start with. He's fine. He's sitting in glory in all the majesty and the power and the dominion that is his by right, and he is ruling the universe as a sovereign at this very moment, and nothing happens in his universe that he doesn't decree and control and empower, and he is not feeling neglected. He is feeling like a judge. And he is making sure that those that belong to him are coming to him, and he's making sure that those that don't belong to him never see his glory. And he's not feeling neglected. He's feeling like what he is. He's feeling like the sovereign right now. And yet these people have the unmitigated audacity to take letters out of a box and go out to their sign in front of their little church and write something as stupid as Jesus feels neglected. Oh, I hate it. I just hate it. I hate Joel Osteen's Better Life Now concept. I hate 40 days of purpose. I hate church signs up the street that say Jesus doesn't refuse anybody. I hate the fact that the supposedly Christian world continues to confuse and confound the people in the pews by telling them outright, unmitigated lies about the God of the Bible in order to gratify their own flesh to sell more product. They are telling lies about God and Christ. And they're not helping those people at all. They're doing exactly what Jesus said the Pharisees did, which was compass land and sea to make one proselyte, and when they have made them, they make them twice the child of hell they are. I hate it. I'm going to start raving in a minute. The people on the internet can't see it, but I'm foaming at the mouth right now. But I'm... I hate it. I just hate it. And I really don't think you can have the Spirit of God in you and not be repulsed by that stuff. Because that stuff is repulsive, and it's repulsive because of this. Bottom line, here's why I'm so repulsed by it. Number one, it does not bring glory to God. It brings glory to whoever it was that whipped up the latest church growth program. The name at the top of that flyer is Rick Warren Presents. But that brings no glory to God. That brings glory to a man. It is a man-centered thing. So I find it repulsive on that level. The second level I find it repulsive on is that it is bringing people into a church environment, quote unquote, making them promises that that church cannot keep, and assuring these dead in their trespass sinners that they're just fine with God if they will look deep enough inside themselves and find their purpose and discover their own strengths, and then they can become significant and important in this world that is from the very pit of hell. And that's what's going on in churches under the name of Jesus Christ. And it's not doing anybody any good. And I get this stuff in my mailbox every week. And I look at it and I just want to beat my head against a wall. And all I hope is that Jesus is coming soon. Because it's a mess down here right now. And the church world has forgotten its purpose. It's forgotten its function. It forgot why it exists. The church thinks it exists to do numbers, bring more people in, and build bigger buildings. It has forgotten that the purpose of the church on earth is to be a representative of Christ in everything that that means. Teaching proper doctrine, teaching his theology, and most importantly, worshiping and praising Christ and him only. But all these man-centered, man-raising programs just keep showing up and showing up so that they can make more money off the back of people by promising them things that Rick Warren can't deliver. Joel Osteen can't deliver. He can fill a building, but he can't deliver. And what he can't deliver is the one thing everybody needs most: forgiveness and salvation. And you can't get forgiveness and salvation till you admit you're a sinner, and you won't admit you're a sinner while you're busy looking inside to find your purpose. You understand that? Okay, I'm going to stop or I'll just continue raving. Here, let me finish up this chapter 15. If I had not come and spoken unto them, this is verse 22 of chapter 15, if I had not come and spoken unto them, they'd have had no sin. But now they have no cloak for their sin. Jesus said, these Pharisees, these religious leaders in Israel, if I hadn't actually been here doing these miracles and making it obvious who I was, then they wouldn't be as guilty as they are now. What did we read from Romans 5? Jeff read this morning from Romans 5 that the law came so that sin would be all the more sin. So the law came through Moses to make sure people knew how sinful they were, to have a standard that God could use to impute sin to people. And then Christ came and said, I'm that. I came and spoke to these people as clearly and as obviously and did these miracles. It is obvious who I am. And since I was here and spoke to them, their sin is even greater now. And yet those are the very people he's going to be turned over to be tortured and killed. Wow. Verse 23, he that hates me hates my Father also. Might as well get that straight. He that hates Christ hates God. There are a lot of people out there who claim to like God and not like Jesus. I like God, but I call him Allah and I go through Muhammad, but I don't like Jesus. Or I'll give him, you know, some kind of props. I'll say that he's a good and wise teacher, or he was a prophet, but, you know, I'm not going to call him God. There are plenty of other groups out there that say they like God and that God is nature and they love Mother Earth, but they have no need of Jesus. Certainly not the Jesus of the Bible or the doctrine of the Bible. Get it straight. They hate God. It's not a popular message. You certainly can't fill a room with it, as I think I'm demonstrating. But it's the truth. And I don't care if the truth hurts. It's the truth. He that hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works that no other man did, they would not have had sin. But now have they both seen and hated both me and my Father. Those very Jews that hated him so much that were going to kill him believed they were doing the work of God when they killed him. But this comes to pass, that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. See that? They had no cause to hate Christ. They have no cause to hate you, but they will. By the way, that's Psalm 69, I believe. I think it also comes up in Psalm 35, the prediction that they would hate him without a cause. Verse 26, but when the Comforter is come, whom I will send unto you from my Father, even the Spirit of truth, which proceeds from the Father, he shall testify of me, and you shall bear witness, because you have been with me from the beginning. So there it is, obvious that he's talking to the 11 who have been with him from the beginning. Next week we'll pick up right there and continue. And you know what? I've got myself all worked up again. But I'd rather stand in a little room like this where I have the freedom to tell the truth exactly the way it's written and say it to a small group of committed people than to have an $80 million building with a giant rotating earth and waterfalls and a giant choir and 80 musicians and put on a big spectacular show every week and not say a thing that's true. I'd rather tell the truth and let the chips fall where they will, because that's just safer ground. Someday, according to Paul, I have to stand before God and give answer for what I said about his son. That's going to be an ugly day for some people, isn't it? I want to be able to stand there and say, I did my best to tell the truth. I just said what's in the book. I just promoted what was in the book. That's the best I've got to work with. And I can live with that. My conscience is clear. I can do that if I just hold to the word. But boy, I don't know how some of those people are going to be able to stand before God in that day and give an answer for the things they said about Christ. I would not want God to be able to whip out a copy of Your Best Life Now on the judgment day.
On behalf of everyone at Grace Christian Assembly, we thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace message. Remember to visit us on the internet at www.salvationbygrace.org. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.